from scratch, from scratch, from scratch, from scratch, from scratch.
Welcome to this week's From Scratch. I'm Martin Cousins and...
My name is Nigel Payne.
This week, dear listener, we have a special guest on From Scratch, and we are delighted to be joined by Paul Matthews. Now, Paul has had a very distinguished career in L&D and continues to do so, and there's no way I could reflect those accomplishments myself, so I'm going to ask Paul to introduce himself properly, and then Nigel is going to take over the questioning. We've got a very interesting topic today, which is nudge theory. So, Paul, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here, and I'm looking forward to having a brief chat. I've been in and around L&D for well over 20 years now, and I've written 3 books in the field, do consultancy and all sorts of things. So I just get really fascinated with things as an engineer background, things that are not working in L&D. And I sort of look at them from an engineering perspective. Well, it's not working. Why is it not working? And that's kind of what drives my research and stuff. And the latest thing I've been looking into is nudge theory. And I find there's some fascinating links with L&D and can help us in L&D, I think.
Okay, Paul. Well, let's start with the obvious question. What is nudge theory? And then tell me, if you can describe it for us, what on earth it has to do with L&D?
Well, nudge theory, we use it all the time in the sense that if we want to convince a friend of ours to go to a movie with us, we'll pump up the idea of the movie saying, it's Tom Cruise playing, I know you love Tom Cruise, let's go to the movie, rather than just saying, let's go to the movie. So you're offering choice in different ways. And effectively what you're doing is you're nudging them in the direction of a choice you would wish them to make. So in effect, you are being what Thaler terms a choice architect. So whenever you're offering a choice to someone, you are by definition a choice architect, because you can make some differences around the choice itself in terms of how you offer it and the context within which you might be offering that choice.
So it's exactly like the way supermarkets put the things they want you to buy on the shelf at eye level. And the
Absolutely.
Things that are maybe a better bargain or they don't want you to buy, they put them low. So they're gently nudging you towards the things that are easiest to pick off the shelf. That's nudge theory, isn't it?
That's kind of nudge. There's lots, and that comes across in so many different examples in terms of how you present that choice. One of the examples I read, which is fascinating, is in the States, the fire service will offer free fire smoke alarms to people. And they found that people, when they turned up at the door, would say, just put one in the hall. And that's not enough. So after some experimentation, they started walking into the house with a clear plastic bag with 5 smoke alarms in it, dump it ostentatiously on the table, look around the dwelling and say, you know, we could probably get away with 3 in here. How many do you want? 3 or 4? And the way they've then framed that choice meant that people were typically taking 3 at least smoke alarms, and therefore they got what they wanted. But of course, they could have still said 1. So one of the definitions of a nudge is you're not denying a choice. That is still a low-cost effort to take the other option, but you're nudging them in a direction. So what you need to be thinking about here is it's almost like benevolent paternalism, if you like, because that's where the ethics comes in. If you nudge them in a way that is counterproductive for someone and profitable, yes, perhaps from the nudger, and so that's where you can get some conflict of interest potentially.
Yeah, like saying, well, Paul, this operation is very important, and only 10% of people end up dying at the end of it. Or they can say, Paul, you really need this operation, 90% success rate.
Absolutely.
And nudging you to say, I'll do it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you say 10% die, you go, oh, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Exactly the same statistic.
Yeah, the
stats are presented
exactly
in a way
same.
That nudge you.
Yeah, totally, correct. And of course, if the person giving that nudge is a surgeon who's going to make a nice consultancy fee out of the operation, they will pitch it in a certain way as opposed to, and so on. So there's all of that thing around, you know, where do you place the different healthier items of food in the school dinner queue on the shelves when the children are picking up their food? Is it to offer them a healthy choice? Is it because that supplier gives me a better kickback when I buy from them? Is it the best profit margin for the people running the cafeteria? Or do you just randomly place the food items, which in itself is a choice? So you can never not be a choice architect. You are always one, whether you're aware of it or not. when someone has a choice and choosing between options perhaps, or to do now or do later, or to do or not to do, and so on. So that's kind of about when nudges happen.
So let's just ease it into L&D. And I can see the logic here that if you want people to behave in a particular way, then you present choices to them in a very clear, conscious way that will encourage them to move in your direction. Is that the kind of thing? So give us some examples of how you think L&D could benefit from Thaler's work and his Nobel Prize.
If you think about at a higher level, if you think about what's the purpose of L&D, and there's lots of them, but one of them clearly is about generating behavior change in the people that are in the organization so they perform better in the moment. If people are going to change behavior, they've got to start doing things. So therefore, we have to be asking them to do things. We're giving them calls to action. Please go and do this. Now, at that point, you're effectively offering a choice to do or not to do. And so the way you're offering or bringing up that call to action to them matters. And some of the work from BJ Fogg from Stanford University comes in here in terms of his model of triggering a behavior is that you've got to have a prompt or a call to action. That person is then going to say, can I do this easily and what my motivation level is right now to do it? And he has a formula B equals MAP, motivation, ability, and prompt. And if you deliver that in a certain way, the chances of the behavior starting is very high. If you do it in a different way, the chance of the behavior starting is low. They'll choose not to do. So how you offer that choice will govern whether that behavior triggers and actually starts. Yes. So clearly, the choice then becomes really important. So this is vital for things like learning transfer, for example. If you're doing a training course, how after the course are you going to be offering choices to people on the actions they must take to embed and sustain those new behaviors over time, hopefully leading into habitual, new ways and cultural change. So there's so much stuff. How you put things on an LMS on a screen, how you set up stuff even within an e-learning course, in terms of the images and things wrapped around it. It was a fascinating experiment they did with students. They brought them in to play a game at a table, and on a side table, they had some objects, and they changed the objects for the different cohorts of students coming in to play this game. Lots and lots of tests. And what they found is that they had a briefcase and a calculator as objects on the table, which they didn't reference and were not part of the game. The competitiveness was much higher than if there were children's toys on that table.
Yeah, I can see that.
And so there was a contextual nudge to a certain type of behavior.
Yes. So what you're saying is that L&D has to be way more sensitive to context, climate, and the nature of choice, and not just imagine that A and B is kind of neutral. It's never neutral. And if you can load it to gently, delicately, and almost unconsciously get people to move in the direction you want, you're going to have far more effective outcomes than if you're just simply not aware of any of that stuff.
Yeah. And people are often completely unaware of when they're being nudged, if the nudge are done subtly and well, like that fire alarm example I used, like a cafeteria, they did experiments on how well people cleaned up after themselves and took their trays to the thing. If they wafted a very gentle smell of cleaning product through the cafeteria, which was almost subliminal, people cleaned up more.
Yeah.
But they were completely unaware of the smell.
Yes. Yes. So how do you embed that in your practice?
Well, a lot of what I do is get one of the areas, of course, my third book was on learning transfer. So of course this fits super well there, is how do you get people experimenting and practicing and doing things in the workflow after they've been to a training course. And so fairly critically, you need to be offering choices to them to say, here, please do this now, do this experiment now. So how you offer that, how you get them involved with that. So for example, you need to make it easy and frictionless. That's one of the things people will, it's like water running downhill. They'll take the easiest route. So that's one of the ways you can nudge, is nudge people in a way to say, here's the easiest route, even when you need to signpost it, because they might not see it automatically themselves. So it's about signposting. It's about focusing attention. And it's also doing things like, fear of missing out is one of the hashtag FOMO. Is people don't want to miss stuff. They also want to do what everybody else is doing. So 80% of people have taken this course and it's benefited them. Okay, there's your hook in effect.
Yes, it's true. It is. It's all about hooks that are subtle and not so subtle, and following through, being conscious of the expectations that you're putting on people, and encouraging a climate where it's more likely that they will make those choices than less likely they will make those choices. This is very important stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway,
the other one in there is this future discounting thing where people discount future gains. So as L&D, we often think this is a wonderful program. It's going to get some great things. In 6 months' time, we'll have all these benefits. So we tend to have a longer term view and are prepared to wait for those future benefits. Whereas the individuals on the program don't have that view. They need a much faster feedback and a much more immediate benefit in order to participate and make the choice to do the action now. So because we think of a program a certain way, then they don't necessarily think of it the same way or have the same drivers.
Yeah. Right. So I think we'll finish there. I think the message is really clear. You just need to be far more conscious about what motivates people to do things. Just because you think it's a good idea doesn't mean that anyone else does.
Absolutely.
But if you can encourage people to do what you want by leading them gently in that direction, you're going to have far more impact in the short term and therefore in the long term.
Yep.
Is that a fair summary, Paul?
Yeah. I mean, there's far more detail under the bonnet, but absolutely. We just got to be more conscious of our position as a choice architect, basically.
I agree. And just using that term, choice architect, should resonate with people.
Yeah.
Paul, it's great talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Brilliant. Thank you for the opportunity to come and stand on my soapbox.
That's great.
Thanks,
very
Paul.
Good. Bye.
Bye-bye then. From scratch.